Thanks. So the work I talk about here would not have been possible without the expertise and co-leadership of three Aboriginal research officers working for Congress in Alice Springs. They should be presenting here instead of me, but have since moved on from Congress to take on roles outside of the organisation. But I really want to acknowledge their important contribution here. The Noongarrbuja Statement demands commitment to action the rights of Indigenous peoples to co-design culturally responsive policies and strategies that match their sexual health priorities, knowledges and practices. This presentation reports on a process where community-based young people with no prior research experience led research and co-design activities in a large setting in the Northern Territory. I just want to locate this study in a much bigger picture, which is the ultimate aim of decolonizing health research through using appropriate methodologies and methods. This requires many things, but here I want to point to several key components. The active leadership role of Aboriginal people in research, recognition that people in Aboriginal communities are experts on their own lives, and that their knowledges and understandings of the world should form the basis for health actions. This is more about abiding by important ethical research protocols. It's about achieving social justice, self-determination, and community control of research. We know that there are unacceptable and persistent sexual health disparities between Aboriginal and non-Indigenous young people, yet there's little published evidence of working with young people as researchers to help resolve these problems themselves. So in this presentation, I discuss the process of working with young Aboriginal people as co-researchers in qualitative research and co-design activities, and emphasise the expertise and insight that they bring to sexual health research. So this was done as part of the MOST trial, which is the More Options for STI Testing trial in the Northern Territory, which is one of many initiatives focused on attempting to rectify these sexual health disparities. It's based in the Northern Territory and aims to evaluate strategies to increase STI testing among young Aboriginal people. So prior to the start of the trial, 8 young people in one remote setting were employed as co-researchers. They were trained to conduct qualitative research to better understand young people's experiences of accessing STI testing and to participate in workshops to co-design the testing strategies that would be used as part of the MOST trial. So like just up front, our key finding from this process is that the capabilities and expertise of young Aboriginal researchers were really strongly evident, unsurprisingly. They completed the training and research responsibilities with enthusiasm, interest, and growing self-esteem. And although a crude measure, according to the average length of interviews, the young peer researchers performed as well as experienced qualitative researchers when conducting in-depth interviews about sensitive sexual health topics. We also achieved a deep data set on a range of topics collected by young people in conversation with other young people about young people's lived experiences. To do this, we used a peer research approach. In Western research terms, this peer research approach first emerged from participatory research paradigm starting in the late 70s, which called for grassroots, community-led problem identification and planning to solve health problems based on the recognition that community members are experts on their own lives. Peer researchers are members of a community who, through research training, become trusted members of a research team and work as researchers within their own communities, taking responsibility for one or more parts of the research cycle from research question identification through analysis through to presentation of findings. The process I just wanted to summarize now consists of 4 stages. And the 8 researchers took part in 4 days of training, which focused on interviewing skills, research ethics, identification of who they would interview, data management, and lots of practice. During the first day and a half of training, we conducted in-depth interviews with all 8 peer researchers, and there were several reasons for doing this. First, it enabled preparation of the draft topic guides that would be used during the research. It was also a teaching opportunity, whereby the peer researchers experienced being interviewed on sensitive topics. And this experience was then drawn on reflectively during training, so that they could appreciate how difficult those kind of research interactions can be. And there was also capability building for the three Aboriginal research officers from Congress who were involved who'd not done qualitative interviewing before. Then to the data collection. So each peer researcher recruited two peers, similar age, same sex, from their social networks who they knew. They conducted three interviews with each interviewee on different themes. The themes in this study were young people's sexual experiences and relationships, awareness of STIs and risk practices, and then STI prevention, risk reduction, testing and treatment. So in between each thematic interview, each researcher took part in a debriefing interview, which was carried out by me and the research officers. And these interviews served several purposes, including data management to make sure that the data was securely saved and in line with confidentiality and data management processes. But we listened to the interview with the youth researchers who could then explain anything that was unclear and also help interpret some of the issues that were talked about in the interviews in a way that wouldn't have been possible for me to do. It also provided training opportunities between the sequence of interviews to make sure that there was improved interviewing technique throughout. And then finally, the peer researchers participated in co-design workshops where we reviewed and reflected on the data they collected. And then using this knowledge and experience gained through the process, they designed two trial strategies, as well as we tried brainstorming other ways of increasing STI testing beyond that as well. So in the rest of the presentation, I just want to reflect on the particular expertise that youth researchers brought to the study, and also reflect on some commitments to try and take this work forwards. Incidentally, there's quite a lot of papers been written about this peer research approach, which I'm happy to send on to anybody interested. So youth researchers were able to navigate complex interactions when interviewing people in their social circles. A 19-year-old female researcher, who was absolutely outstanding, explained that she had deliberately chosen interviewees with contrasting personalities to ensure that she explored a range of different sexual health experiences that young people might be experiencing. She said, one interview was happy to share stories and talk about it. I couldn't get her to stop talking. She was a good person to interview. I didn't even ask the question, but at the end, when trying to talk about how to improve services, she was like, oh, we need to improve on this and that. She just listed them out. In contrast, she said her other interviewee was shy, feeling more shame when sharing her thoughts about the interview topics. But the researcher explained that's just how she is at the time. All the time, sorry. And the interview experience was simply exacerbated the situation, which made the interview experience difficult, but she identified various efforts to overcome these challenges during the data collection process. She explained that she reassured the interviewee that it was okay to speak the truth and that the research was to help other young Indigenous people. But she realised that she had to be more patient and encouraging and to let the interviewee have space to answer. They developed reflective practice through review and analysis of their interview recordings, identifying improvements in research skills. Data from the interviewing interviews that we conducted identified a number of different skills. One example was taking a bit more time to interrogate interviewees' responses through particular use of prompting and probing questions to unpack what they've said. Another, which is a really hard skill to learn in qualitative research, was responding to the conversation rather than working strictly to a topic guide, letting the conversation flow more freely. So listening and asking questions in response to what's been said rather than what's on the paper in front. And then another tricky skill is using silence in combination with body language to elicit contribution. Reflecting on his recordings, a 19-year-old male researcher said, listening to the answers, I think the main thing for me was just to give them a bit more time. And when I asked how he might do that, he said, I should just relax in the process. If there's silence, there's silence. It doesn't matter. Just let them fill it. And after practicing these skills during the second interview, he said, it was much easier. It just felt like fluid, easy-flowing stuff. It was more of a conversation than a question and answer process. Another area was the ability to interpret body language. Initially, a 16-year-old male researcher described how awkward he felt asking respondents about STIs and sexual health. He just said, "I just felt so rude asking about it," which then led to stilted questions and short answers, all to do with the awkwardness of the interaction. But then later in the process, he started to reflect on an interviewee's body language when talking about peer pressure to have sex at a party. He said, "I think just the look on his face, I think he was talking, thinking about what's happened with him, looking at the ground and looking really lost and stuff. Maybe he's got drunk and had sex, whatever. Maybe it's happened to him." This ability to reflect on and interpret the meaning of body language in relation to what they're saying during the interviews is one of many skills that were developed beyond asking a question and listening to the answer. And finally, they designed and advised on the development of two strategies to enhance STI testing. The first was an incentive scheme for clinic-based STI testing, where their ideas and recommendations were used to establish the type and value of the incentive, establish which specific aspects of the test, treat, and retest cycle should be incentivized, as well as the clinical protocol relating to the timing and location of the offer and distribution of incentives by a clinician to maintain client confidentiality within the service setting. So this strategy is currently being evaluated at the moment in the trial. A second strategy was involved adapting the existing Aboriginal liaison officer role to ensure confidential home-based urine collection for testing without having to access a clinic. Due to the challenges with syphilis at the time of the research and the difficulties collecting bloods using this strategy, we couldn't trial this, but we will publish it as it's a really interesting idea. So, significance of these findings. First, we illustrate that young Aboriginal people can and should lead the development of solutions to sexual health problems based on their lived experiences. Oh, bugger. How do we go back? Oh, there you go, red button. And second, the peer research methodology. Involved Aboriginal community members who were new to research as co-leaders in health research. Centralises their perspective and knowledges in research, which hopefully will lead to change in practice as a result of the trial findings. And facilitates two-way capability building and learning new skills of both Aboriginal and non-Indigenous researchers involved in the process. That said, there were obviously weaknesses with our approach and the sustainability of our approach. Not least that we lost contact with the youth researchers after the research cycle described here had finished and the Aboriginal researchers had moved on. So there's a lot of reflecting going on in terms of how we did it and how we would do things again in the future. Sticky button. There you go. So in recognition of Aboriginal people's historical and contemporary experience of disempowerment in research, offering young people one-off research experiences is insufficient. We need more enduring forms of co-investigation with young researchers beyond the cycle of data collection and analysis allowed for by one research study. Also ensuring that they're involved in research design processes well before the data is collected. And we also need to ensure support for community researchers to gain research qualifications to support recognition of their skills and enhance future employability in research. There's obviously roles for non-Indigenous researchers here as well. And as a non-Indigenous person from the UK who's been in Australia 6 years, working in this area since 2015 with a very, very steep learning curve, I've reflected a lot on my role and responsibilities in the work, particularly when in community observing and talking and learning from my Aboriginal research friends and colleagues. We cannot shirk our responsibilities to support bigger agendas around decolonisation of health research. So I guess there's a number of ways that we can do this, but I guess it's also probably worth pointing out that our role is to support in a way determined by Aboriginal research colleagues to the point where we're no longer needed to support. And just to wrap up, there's a heap of people involved in this work, but I'd particularly like to acknowledge and thank James for ongoing guidance, for the young researchers who were responsible for doing this work so well, as well as Congress research officers and the board. Thank you very much.